Fred and Rose West are Britain's most prolific and sadistic serial-killing couple.
They derive so much pleasure, sexual and otherwise, from the pain of others.
How did an ordinary family home in Gloucester become a sordid den of sex, vice and murder?
Nothing prepared me for what I met with Rose. Nothing.
A place of orgies and prostitution converted into a torture chamber.
You want to believe that they're going to let you go, that nobody can be that bad.
12 girls and young women would be butchered before the killers were stopped.
I saw Rose as interested in violence and lesbian sex, pretty much in equal measure and preferably together, and that Fred's role was in many ways to assist her to fulfil her fantasies.
June 1971, and in the cellar of a flat in Gloucester, an 8-year-old girl lay dead.
Rose, girl. What have you done?
It's believed Fred West had killed before and got away with it, but this was the first time Rose had taken a life.
From that moment on, there's a change in their relationship because they're locked in a deadly embrace. They both have, by that moment, killed.
The girl in the cellar was Fred's 8-year-old stepdaughter, Charmaine. She'd been living with Fred and Rose at their flat on Midland Road in Gloucester. Fred wasn't the girl's father. She was the daughter of his estranged first wife, Rena. Also in the house was Fred's daughter with Rena, Anne Marie. 17-year-old Rose had been left looking after the girls while Fred was in prison, serving a 9-month jail sentence for theft.
There was a bad relationship from the start between Rose and Charmaine. Rose knocked her about and mistreated her and was very cruel towards her.
While Fred was in prison, the level of abuse suffered by Charmaine increased. Rose was adept at hiding it, even from Fred's family.
He was strict on the kiddies, so, I mean, fair enough. But, I mean, apart from that, there was no evidence that anything else was wrong.
Rose had killed Charmaine on her own. Fred had been locked up at the time.
We better get this sorted out.
But he now took charge of disposing of Charmaine's body, becoming party to the crime.
It's what's called joint enterprise. If you and I take part in a conspiracy to murder somebody, and I strangle them and you hide the body, we're both guilty.
Fred buried Charmaine behind the flat. He always denied dismembering the body, but the facts suggest this was a lie.
Fred insisted that he couldn't bring himself to mutilate a child. But in fact, when her remains were found, her skeleton wasn't intact and parts were missing.
Rose has always denied she was involved in any of the 12 murders, but Charmaine's death became key evidence at her trial.
Fred was in jail during that period, and we were able to establish that that Charmaine was at home with Rose, and so the jury was satisfied that Rose was the person who killed Charmaine.
Very best friend, hadn't she?
At the time, Fred and Rose avoided suspicion by giving neighbours a cover story they'd stick to for the next 24 years.
She's gone to live with Rena, her mother. Good bloody riddance, too.
Fred's family were spun the same line. When they came to visit, all seemed normal.
The children used to go and play together, and we'd have tea and chat and something, and that was it. We never, ever see anything. They hid it well.
But within days, the first crack appeared in the relationship between Fred and Rose. She walked out on Fred and returned to her family home and to the father who, it suggested, had sexually abused her from an early age.
Rose's childhood had been difficult, and her father, Bill Letts, had been an aggressive, violent, difficult man.
He'd washed his hands of Rose over her attachment to Fred.
Look, I've finished with him.
You made your bed, girl. You lie in it.
But this is my home. wrong?
It's not my problem.
Dad!
Fred came to fetch her back. This conversation was repeated in court when Rose's mother testified against her.
Come on, Rose.
It formed key prosecution evidence.
You know what we've got between us. If you ain't out of here in 10 minutes, there'll be another woman in our bed.
Don't look at me. You know what I think.
You don't even know him. You don't even know him. There's nothing he wouldn't do. Not even murder.
The die is cast. Fred and Rose, from then on in, are pretty much a solid couple.
Rose was back with Fred, and he thought he'd got away with murder again. But they hadn't counted on the tenacity of Charmaine's birth mother, Rena. The previous year, she'd visited Fred and Rose's caravan to try to get Charmaine and Anne-Marie back. But Rose had refused to hand over the girls. Now, a year later, Rena was back, looking for her children. She called to see Fred's father, Walter. He was surprised because he'd believed the cover story that Charmaine was with her in Scotland. Increasingly anxious, Rena left to find Fred.
She's asking Fred, and he's palming her off with a lie, because, of course, she can't have Charmaine back because Charmaine is dead.
Rena's persistent questions had become too dangerous for Fred and Rose. Finally, Fred said he would meet her to take her to Charmaine.
Took your time.
It was a promise that could only lead to one ending.
Shut it!
In mid-1971, just 2 months after Rose had murdered Fred's 8-year-old stepdaughter, Charmaine, her mother, Fred's first wife, Rena, returned to Gloucestershire and asked to see her daughter. Fred and Rose knew Rena may discover the terrible truth.
We suspect that Rena didn't really know the full depth of Fred's depravity. She probably didn't know that he was a killer. He lies to her. He says, I'll take you to Charmaine, but first let's have a drink. He gets her drunk.
It's believed when she could no longer resist, he murdered her in his car, asphyxiating her. Years later, chromium tubing and a toy red boomerang would be found with her remains.
Fred and Rose both had this absolute obsession, the idea of perverse use of objects, of using rubber, of containment, of tubing.
It's thought Fred took Rena back to Midland Road to dismember her. He kept a kneecap and other bones as trophies. He buried her in a field near Muchmarkle. In the field next door lay the 16-year-old girl believed to be Fred's first victim, his lover, and the children's former nanny, Anna McFall. Though Fred always denied killing Anna, in 1994, he took police to the graves of both young women. No one reported Rena missing.
Well, we assumed she'd gone back to Scotland.
With Rena and Charmaine out of the way, the relationship between Rose and Fred entered a new phase.
She was sort of gradually taking over him. She was becoming more and more the boss, which eventually she took over completely.
Fred and Rose married in January 1972 and went on honeymoon.
But the really weird part about this is that it's not just Fred and Rose, it's Fred and Rose and another girl who they've picked up somewhere along the line, who is part of this bizarre menage.
18-year-old Rose was pregnant and wanted a bigger home for their growing family. They bought a house that would become notorious. 25 Cromwell Street in Gloucester's Bedsit Land. Catherine Halliday rented a flat nearby.
I mean, Cromwell Street, you could be anonymous and live in it because it was a lot of bed and breakfast, DSS. People came and went all the time. You didn't stay in Cromwell Street for very long.
From the start, sex was at the centre of life there for Fred and Rose, as the trial later heard from two lodgers.
Within hours of moving into 25 Cromwell Street, Rose slept with them. And soon, almost everyone was sleeping with everyone else.
Years later, when Fred and Rose faced trial, Howard Ogden was appointed as Fred's solicitor.
He was rather in her shadow, and I felt that she was the strong one. I saw Rose as someone who was interested in violence and lesbian sex, pretty much in equal measure and preferably together, and that Fred's role was in many ways to assist her to fulfil her fantasies.
Neighbour Catherine Halliday saw at first hand how this worked. She first met Fred in her flat.
There was nothing at all in Fred's way to suggest anything but a bumbling, goofy, builder, happy-go-lucky chap, and that is how he came across. I liked the guy. When I first met him, I liked him.
He quickly established she was lesbian.
Yeah, he wants to pop up and see our Rosie. She loves a bit of that, you know.
Catherine accepted the invitation, and Fred took her into Rose's bedroom.
Nothing prepared me for what I met with Rose. Nothing. All of a sudden, out of the corner of my eye, I just caught this image of this woman, naked, coming into the room. Now, I'm pretty broad-minded, but that took me completely off my balance. She just draped herself over me. We didn't make love, we had sex. Fred didn't join in. It was her and me. And all the time he was on about Rose and give Rose a good time and she'll give you a good time.
Catherine returned to the house for sex sessions several times.
But she was very, very domineering, very much so. And she was quite domineering over Fred too.
You want to go make yourself useful? Go get my dressing gown.
He only ever touched me once. We only ever had sex once. But he was a wee bit more gentle. But she was very cold, very cold.
Shortly after moving into Cromwell Street, Fred began converting the house so he and Rose could explore sadistic sex.
One of the most sinister things he does is that he turns the basement of the house into a torture chamber.
One of the first girls he took there was his own 8-year-old daughter, Anne Marie. She later described in court how Fred and Rose raped her and told her she should be grateful. She said she wanted to die.
For Fred, the introduction of sex into a girl's life experience was the role of her father. It was the father's responsibility to break in their daughters. You don't want any other bastard doing that, he said, do you?
Shortly after Fred and Rose began abusing Anne Marie in 1972, they met a 16-year-old, Caroline Owens. Her story provides a unique insight into what awaited their victims.
It was almost like, oh, yeah, we're just going to rape you or decently assault you. And because we're going to make you a cup of tea after, then we can't be all bad. There is a word I'd like to use, but I can't.
What is it?
Edfuck. Complete edfuck. Because you want to believe that they're going to let you go, that nobody can be that bad. But a part of you don't believe that.
The information that Caroline Owens was able to give us was really very, very important in the case. What happened to her in 72 was a thread that then ran through the other cases.
It began late that year, as Caroline was hitchhiking to her family home after being with her boyfriend. Fred and Rose had started trawling the countryside for girls to join Rose in prostitution.
They'd come back and say they'd been trying to pick up girls out of care who had nobody, so obviously wouldn't be missed.
Hi there, darling. Wanna hop in? It looks like you're going our way.
That'd be great.
During the journey, Caroline revealed she had problems at home and was looking for work.
We're after a nanny.
Oh, right. Ooh, that'd be really good.
Yeah, brilliant.
She was going to be the nanny of a man and a woman who were married and who had children and who seemed outwardly to be respectable.
It was quite a nice atmosphere to begin with. They were very, like, they had a bawdy sense of humour, which was crude, but also could be funny. There were other times when it felt a bit strange, a bit uncomfortable.
Right, Car.
Hi, Louise. The kids been all right? They've been fine.
Oh, good.
Fred offered to help if she ever had an unwanted pregnancy.
He said to me, like, yeah, I performed these abortions before and they're so grateful they just turn around and have sex with me straight after, which I thought, that's not right, that's weird.
Caroline soon saw signs of Rose's aggression towards 8-year-old Anne-Marie, the daughter of Fred and Rena.
I'm just going to get a glass of water.
Okay.
Rose lost her temper with her on a few occasions.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
I'm just going to get a glass of water.
You'll have absolutely nothing back in your bed now!
One evening, Fred was explicit about Anne-Marie's sexual abuse.
She ain't no virgin.
Anne-Marie was in the room at the time and I saw her face go down and blush.
Why would you... What do you mean she ain't a virgin? Why ain't she a virgin?
I think it was almost like a test to see if I was curious. I think he thought that he could groom me.
Hey, nothing like that now, was he?
Fred backtracked, coming up with a story to explain away what he'd said.
He said, oh, she had an accident on a push bike and the saddle came off and the part the saddle sits on penetrated her.
Fred now feared Caroline might reveal what he'd said. She was about to discover how manipulative he could be. Since moving in, she cheated on her boyfriend with a lodger, and Fred and Rose had found out.
You wouldn't care about what you're thinking, innit?
He was blackmailing me.
You wouldn't want your boyfriend finding out about all this bed-hopping you've been doing here.
However, Fred's hostility soon evaporated. He and Rose tried to draw Caroline into their world.
You know, like then, Car?
The characteristic manipulation by psychopathic individuals is one of charm and disarm. It's a cat-and-mouse game.
He said, oh, me and Rose, a couple of friends, we've got a sex circle.
That's something you might be interested in?
I knew that was definitely something I didn't ever want to be a part of.
Caroline had seen and heard enough. Just weeks after taking the job, she walked out on the Wests. But she wasn't out of their clutches yet. Rose had wanted sex with Caroline and was furious. She and Fred devised a plan to use their charm to abduct and rape her. Caroline was vulnerable. Age 13, she'd been sexually assaulted by an old man in public toilets.
He's lying. Why are you believing him?
The incident destroyed her self-esteem and trust in the establishment.
People not only did not believe her, they actually sympathised with the person that she'd accused of the sexual assault. This is the 60s. This is before we began to really understand about the levels of sexual abuse against children in our culture.
I just felt like nobody cared about what happened to me, and I just felt I was doomed to probably die young and probably at the end of some crazy person of some sort. And it was almost like, do you know what, I don't care.
She was very nearly proved right. On December the 6th, 1972, now age 17, she was hitchhiking home after seeing her boyfriend, Tony.
Rose knew exactly where Caroline would be and at what time of the night, and they set out and trailed her.
Fred later told police the plan that night was to sexually assault and perhaps murder Caroline.
I was thinking they're going to be really angry with me because of how I left.
Car, darling, what are you doing? Come on. Look, we're so sorry about before. Look, we're all really missing you. All of us, the kids, just... We were really hoping you'd come home.
Come on, Car, get in.
Come on, get in the car.
Come on, we're having a laugh.
This is awful weather. You're home. Come on, get in. Get in.
Rosie will get in the back with you.
Caroline Owens had no idea she was about to become the only known victim to survive a full-on attack by Fred and Rose. Caroline Owens, the 17-year-old former nanny of Fred and Rose West, didn't realise she'd just been abducted. She'd earlier rejected Fred and Rose's sexual advances, and now they wanted revenge.
You've been at Tony's, have you?
Yeah.
Had sex, have you?
What?
Had sex, have you?
No.
Check her out, Rosie.
Get off, Rose! Stop it!
How'd she do that with us?
I blacked out. When I came back round, my hands were already tied behind my back, and there was Fred wrapping tape around my mouth.
Caroline was bundled into 25 Cromwell Street. Her account of the 12 hours that followed provides unique insight into the sadism and torture that accompanied the subsequent murders. 23 years later, her first-hand testimony would prove crucial in court.
This has all got out of hand, Caroline. We didn't want to have to hurt you. Now I'll take that tape off, but you keep quiet, right? God, I'm so sorry, Caroline. You all still right?
He was really apologetic about this little scratch on my face, which to me was kind of crazy because he thought nothing of punching me until I was knocked out.
This faux profession of love, affection, care for their victim is merely a device so as to get closer to the victim so that they can ultimately do them even greater harm.
Psychopaths, and indeed paedophiles and sexual predators, have quite a high capacity for cognitive empathy, which really means an understanding of what other people might be thinking. And this is very different to affective empathy, which is feeling what the other person may be experiencing.
Rose was 3 months pregnant.
Cara, guess what? Well, Rose, she's got another bun in the oven. So now she's gonna need you more than ever. Why don't you move back in with us, eh?
Come on, Mom. Me and the kids, I missed you so much. Just come home. Things will be different this time.
Mommy, get off me!
Well, she's struggling. Come on.
I started shouting, and they gagged me. But this time they used, like, cotton wool and some kind of piece of white cotton material.
Stick it in there. That's it.
Caroline was stripped.
It was embarrassing because I'd never actually been naked in front of any of my boyfriends. It was always a case of under the sheets type of thing.
Come on. What's wrong with you?
Fred said he'd found a physical problem with Caroline, but could sort it.
Because of all his talk about abortions, first thing that came to my mind when he said there was something wrong with my genitalia was it's going to be some kind of operation. I was just petrified. I thought I was going to be operated on when I was still conscious.
Right, Rose, hold her legs open.
Rose had grabbed my legs and held them apart. And he must have took his belt off. I was just more relieved that it was that and not a knife. Rose must have got some water and she was wiping me down with cotton wool.
Finally, she thought she might escape.
Help me! Help!
At that point, I thought I might die.
What Fred and Rose said to her next would years later form key prosecution evidence.
You stupid little bitch!
We're gonna put you in the cellar! You're my friends,
They're gonna use you night and day!
When they've finished, we're gonna bury you under the paving stones of Gloucester!
We've got hundreds of girls down there! They didn't find them and they won't find you!
That, to me, was the lowest point then. And I just wished I'd died.
Then, whilst Rose was out of the room, Fred raped Caroline.
He wasn't rough for me, he was very gentle with me. To me, it felt like he just wanted to have a little go at me as well.
And suddenly, she saw a chink in their relationship.
Sorry, Cara. Shouldn't have done that. You're supposed to be here for Rose's pleasure, not mine. Don't tell her what I've done, she'll kill us. Listen, if you promise not to tell her, move back here to live. I'll let you go. Okay?
Caroline pretended to go along with the plan and went with Rose and the West's baby daughter, May, to the laundrette. Then she made her escape.
Here you go, Rose.
Oh, hello.
Oh. She's going to go get some fags, all right?
Caroline's mother persuaded her to go to the police, where a detective questioned her to test her story.
He was quite a big, intimidating guy. It was like he was accusing me, saying, "Why, you've had sex with this person, you've had sex with that person." It just made me feel really bad about myself.
Caroline couldn't face a similar grilling in court, so didn't press charges of rape.
This is before we really started to think long and hard about how rape victims were treated by the police and by the criminal justice system when they went to court.
Instead, Fred and Rose were jointly charged with indecent assault causing actual bodily harm. In January 1973, they were fined a total of £100.
Here's the thing. They learned from that attack on Caroline. They learned one particular thing, that if they didn't want to get arrested and charged and appear in court, then the next time they wouldn't let their victim survive.
There was so much just guilt about all that. I just made everything worse. It's almost like, oh, well, we got away with it, but only by the skin of our teeth. So next time they gotta die.
We now move into another phase of their murderous career, whereby they murder a series of young girls as part of a depraved campaign of rape.
Cromwell Street became a killing factory. Over the next 9 months, three girls would die. 19-year-old Linda Goff was the girlfriend of a tenant. Like Caroline, the Wests asked her to be nanny. In April 1973, she left a note for her parents, saying she was leaving home. She moved in with the Wests.
You know, you've got the loveliest face.
Now, they could pick their moment. Linda was gagged and bound, like Caroline. It's not known how long Fred and Rose kept her alive.
People assume these are girls who were simply murdered in some traditional way, in that you're suffocated or you're stabbed or whatever it was. And these did not come into that category.
Many of the West victims were tortured. Several of Linda's bones were missing when her dismembered remains were found. Fred claimed he cut up bodies so they'd fit in a small, quickly dug grave. But Linda's burial shows this was a lie. She was dumped in his vehicle inspection pit, which could easily have held her intact body.
The truth, surely, is that he enjoyed cutting her up.
But on this, their first sex killing, they made two miscalculations. Firstly, Rose sorted through Linda's clothes and kept the one she liked. Secondly, Linda had a mother concerned enough to come looking for her.
When we recovered Linda Goff's remains, we interviewed both parents, and it was a very touching an almost surreal description by Mrs. Goff of going round to Cromwell Street.
She saw Linda's clothes on the washing line.
right. Hello?
I'd like a word with Linda. I'm her mum.
Linda? Oh, no, Linda's moved. She moved to Weston-super-Mare. She's looking for work.
She said that as she looked at Rose, she noticed that Rose was wearing Linda's slippers.
Glad to see the back of her.
I just want to have a word.
The Goths presumed Linda had left some belongings behind. They told a neighbour, who was a policeman, that she was missing. But as Linda wasn't thought vulnerable, it wasn't pursued. The Goths tried to trace her themselves, but in the end, simply accepted Rose's account.
The normal response is, my daughter's gone. She's... I don't know where she is. But I suspect what happens is the parent thinks, well, I know that they're trying to make something of themselves.
Within weeks, the West set out to kill again. They'd fine-tuned their system for abduction and killing.
Victim choice is absolutely crucial in relation to thinking about the West as serial killers. One group tended to be much younger, have very damaged backgrounds, and were often not even reported missing because there was nobody to report them as missing. They were runaways.
The Wests used the hitchhiker abduction technique they developed with Caroline Owens. On the 10th of November, 1973, they spotted Carol Ann Cooper. She was 15 and living in a children's home in Worcester.
There was evidence later that Fred had pre-prepared her grave.
This is for you.
What do you mean?
What do you think?
The basement becomes not only the torture chamber, but the burial place for several of the victims, starting with Carol Ann Cooper.
She was reported missing, but to West Mercia Police, not Gloucestershire. The couple's next victim, in December 1973, was from a very different background. She was 21, a university student, living with her mother near Cheltenham.
Lucy Partington is middle class. She's the niece of Kingsley Amis, the famous novelist, cousin of Martin Amis, also a famous novelist.
She is part of the second distinct group of victims, educated, older than the first group of victims.
Sweetheart, what are you doing waiting for a bus in this horrible weather?
And I think Rose was quite central, crucial in convincing intelligent young women that it was safe to accept a lift from somebody like Fred West.
It's not known how long Lucy's ordeal lasted. It's believed Fred and Rose did not allow all their victims to die quickly.
An act-focused serial killer simply wants the victim dead as quickly as possible. Process-focused serial killers, like the Wests, want to stay in the moment of killing for as long as possible because it's those moments of killing that give them the greatest amount of psychosexual pleasure.
Lucy was reported missing, and there was a big murder investigation. But as with Carol, no link was traced to the Wests. In April 1974 came another 21-year-old educated victim. Theresa Siegenthaler, a Swiss sociology student, was on her way from London to Holyhead.
The Wests had worked out how to disappear people, how to abduct smoothly, efficiently, kill and disappear those victims without anybody being able to trace those victims back to Fred and Rose.
That November, Shirley Hubbard, a 15-year-old in care, was subjected to an extreme form of bondage.
When they found her remains, she'd been encased in tape and other bonds, so she was almost in a cocoon. And to make sure that she could breathe whilst they tormented her, they inserted this pipe into her nasal passage so that she could be tortured and her scream would be completely muffled.
Months later, Juanita Mott, 18 and from a broken home, became the next victim. Her family never reported her missing. Hers was the fifth burial in the cellar, which was now full. The house was already a brothel, and at about this time, the West began prostituting Fred's daughter, Anne-Marie, now aged 12.
They introduce her to men they meet in pubs.
Get in!
To some of Rose's clients.
It's believed the Wests were also physically abusing their children because they were taken to accident and emergency 31 times.
They took them to different hospitals. They didn't all stay in the same hospital. They were smart like that. But we had children with sexually transmitted disease, I think, on one occasion. Well, hang on, how did that happen to a child?
If a number of agencies had just joined up the dots, then we wouldn't be sitting here talking today about the numbers of young women who would end up murdered.
The next victim wasn't killed for sexual thrills. Shirley Robinson, who was 18, made the fatal mistake of coming between Fred and Rose. She moved in as a lodger in 1977.
You're right there, my darling. Get everything sorted, okay?
It would later be claimed in court she developed a sexual relationship with both Rose and Fred.
She becomes pregnant with Fred's child. He really likes her. And as she grows closer to Fred, there's the feeling within the household that he may actually leave Rose.
Shirley had become a threat to Fred's marriage.
Hey. Hey. Meet my next wife.
Fred chose Rose. Shirley felt abandoned and threatened. In May 1978, 8.5 months pregnant, she was murdered in a frenzy. Shirley's body was found smashed apart, probably with an axe.
When she dies, her child dies, and this is Fred's child. Essentially, what we see is a double murder. Not only is it a double murder, it's the murder of his own child.
The baby's tiny skeleton was found alongside its mother. The number of Fred and Rose's joint victims now stood at 8. Their killing and betrayal was about to sink to new depths.
Wait a minute.
In 1994, when the West's crimes were at last exposed, police faced questions about how so many girls could simply vanish.
We need to be clear about what information the Gloucestershire police had. Only one or two of these people had ever been reported missing in Gloucestershire.
One of those was Alison Chambers, aged 16, the West's last known sadosexual murder victim. In 1979, she lived at Jordan's Brook Care Home in Gloucester. Fred had started hanging around outside to offer lifts to girls. Like others, Alison was taken back to meet Rose.
She has this rather touching fantasy of the life that she would like to lead, which is living in the country in a sort of cottage with, you know, ivy round the door.
Rose showed her a property she said she and Fred owned.
When you're 17, you can come and visit us on our farm.
In fact, the photo came from an estate agent's brochure. Alison was completely taken in and wrote to her mother she'd moved in happily with her family. She was murdered one day that August. A belt wrapped around her skull was still there when her body was found.
After her disappearance, her parents received some information, I think it was a postcard or something, where they were satisfied that Alison was safe and well. Other children, their parents knew they'd gone missing but did not report it to the police. So the police in Gloucestershire had no reason to believe that any of these people were victims.
The Wests were increasingly fearful their own children would reveal what they knew. To prevent Anne-Marie talking after school, she was forced to run straight home and was beaten if late.
The Wests are very nervous. This is a very dangerous time.
Shortly before her 16th birthday, Anne-Marie left home in 1980. With her gone, Fred attempted to have sex with his younger daughter, Heather.
Get out!
Shush now, Heather.
No!
I told you a dad can touch his children.
No, I told you, get out!
And I told you, didn't I? A dad can touch his children.
No, get out! Shh. No, get out!
It's my right! She's a bloody lesbian, I'm telling you.
What do you think you're doing, talking to your dad that way?
Get out!
And then there starts this story Fred and Rose would repeat ad nauseam, that Heather was unnatural, that she was a lesbian, that she was giving children drugs, which I'm sure was all completely untrue.
By 1987, there were 8 children living in the house, with Heather the oldest at 16. The youngest was just 4 years old. tensions deepened after Fred and Rose discovered Heather had mentioned details about her home life at school, including the fact that Rose had lovers at Cromwell Street.
What she has to do is she has to get away, like Anna Marie got away. And her ambition is to get a job that will somehow enable her to leave home.
In June 1987, Heather left school and was pinning her hopes on a possible job at a holiday camp.
Yeah, this is Heather. Oh.
One of the kids told me that she cried when she told that she wasn't going to get the job. And really, this was her death sentence. One day that she was in the house with her siblings, they went to school, they came back from school. It was a rainy day, they remember. And when they came home, Heather wasn't there.
Heather's remains showed her murder, dismemberment and decapitation were done in a frenzy.
This was an explosion of Fred's innermost rage inflicted on someone who stood in his and Rose's way.
Heather's body was stored overnight in a bin under the stairs. Her brothers and sisters were told the bin was full of old plaster and that Heather had left. Fred's family, including his then 7-year-old niece, were spun the same cover story, which would stick till the arrests.
I remember Grandad asking Fred once how she was getting on, and Rose answering instead of Fred and saying that she'd got some job on in some holiday camp somewhere, and they got a letter if she felt like it, and they were letting her live her life.
In fact, Heather was buried beneath Fred's new patio in the garden behind 25 Cromwell Street. His niece, Sam, joined the barbecue party to celebrate its completion. Heather was the last known murder victim, killed because Fred and Rose feared she'd talk. But others survived to expose the truth. Catherine Halliday began her relationship with Rose a year later.
We'd chatter, we would laugh and we'd talk and different things, and we'd watch blue movies. But then she started to get really, really heavy. This is what we
call. Fred and Rose produced a secret suitcase. Inside were implements of sexual torture and rubber gimp suits.
That just made me realise it's time to go, get out when you can, because they had little zips across the mouth, had no nose holes for breathing, or no eye slits.
The sex became still more brutal. One day, Catherine found she'd been cut with a knife. She'd had enough and changed plans to spend Christmas with the Wests.
I think that that is what saved my life. Rose went ballistic when I said I wasn't going to stay there. I survived Fred and Rose, and it scares me. It scares me that I allowed myself to come so close to death, if you like.
When Catherine agreed to make this film, she'd just been diagnosed with liver cancer. She knew she did not have long to live.
I said I would agree to do it because I wanted to prove that I survived Cromwell Street.
Catherine lived for 24 years after meeting the Wests.
It was nothing to do with them. They did not get me in the end. It wasn't them.
What finally called time on Fred and Rose was an admission by a 13-year-old girl.
I've been raped.
What?
Are you being serious?